My name is, we'll have to watch out with the head tilt there, Dr. April Yuki, and I'll be beginning the talk this evening and then handing it over to Mark Bambara, who will finishing up the talk. And I need to grab my notes. So mindfulness is a skill that some people kind of inherently have, but other people like myself need to learn it. I first became aware of the need to have this skill in my life after I had my second child. I recall driving to work and thinking about the hundreds of things that I needed to get done that day, reviewing all the perceived mistakes that I had made the day before, the week before, maybe even the month before, and kind of realizing I wasn't really enjoying all the things that I was running around and doing. I was, you know, very preoccupied with this to-do list or things that I missed. And so I wrestled with this question, you know, like, is this what life is about? You know, just constantly being on the go and never enjoying things. And then I was introduced to mindfulness at a wellness seminar, and I learned that there is a slightly different way to approach life. I could prioritize myself better. I could learn to be in the moment, not preoccupied by my to-do list or ruminating about the past. And it could allow me to enjoy more moments in life. So this picture is a reminder to me of a very mindful moment that I had that I don't think that I would have had I not been exposed to mindfulness. My daughter and I were on a Caribbean island waiting to get back on our cruise ship, and we had waited a little bit late, and so there was a very long line, and it was extremely hot. I'm a grumpy person when I'm hot. And I stood there, and I started to sense the frustration building of how long it was going to take to get back on this boat, and I had to get my kids ready so we could go to dinner. And you know, I started to notice, oh gosh, this does not feel very good. And in the past, I probably would have continued to kind of ruminate on this and get very kind of agitated and short with the people around me and why aren't they moving faster? But because of learning this skill, I reminded myself that I didn't have to do that. And I could do something else. And so I took a deep breath and let it out and said, well, let me just enjoy my last few moments on this island. There's green lush bushes around me, the sky is blue, and then I noticed the trees kind of rustling, and my daughter was over there, and so then we found this family of crabs, and they were just digging around and foraging and doing all these amazing things that these small creatures could do. And I don't know how long we standed in line because I was in the moment enjoying it with my daughter. And I imagine I'll remember that for quite a long time. But I don't think that I would have had that moment had I not learned this skill. Keeping in mind, however, that mindfulness is not a prescription for, you know, instant happiness or gonna cure everyone's problems or, you know, make everything go away. There's no silver bullets in life. But it can be a very helpful tool, not just for enjoying life, but you'll see later some of the other benefits that we'll talk to you about. So in order to understand how mindfulness is helpful, it's helpful to understand how your brain actually works. So how many of you have driven somewhere and couldn't remember a portion of your drive? Has that happened to anybody in this room? I know it's happened to me. Okay. So that in the mindfulness world is called autopilot. That means just like in an airplane, you inadvertently, not knowingly, switched on this autopilot and you were just doing what you do every day and not having to think. This is actually an evolutionary survival mechanism so that we can, you know, spend less energy on certain activities, but also so that we can then be focused on where do we need to find food or where do we need to avoid an issue. And the interesting thing is they've done studies at Harvard that shows that people throughout the day spend about 50% of their time in this autopilot mode. When you are not engaged in a very specific task, this network comes online within seconds. And how do they know this? Well, in the advent of today, we have science called functional MRI. So you may have heard of an MRI machine. That can show you anatomy of the brain. Okay, structures, physical structures like this podium. But a functional MRI shows you where activity is occurring right at the moment. So these bright spots here of red and yellow are areas that are activated. And, you know, the science of this is very in its infancy. So at this point, though, when people are in autopilot mode, they see these areas of the brain light up. This one here, you'll see, is the biggest area. This is called the posterior cingulate gyrus. And this is a portion of your medial frontal lobe, but you can tell the brighter area there is the most activated. So another way to think about how this is activated or functioning is to consider autopilot. When you're on autopilot, right, you're usually thinking about a lot of things too. Like half of you right now are probably thinking about what happened earlier today or what you're going to do next after this until you come back to my voice. And because these are powerful distractors to us, these thoughts, okay? And when you're doing that, you're lighting up this posterior cingulate gyrus. And then when you bring your attention back, then this area is less activated. In addition to getting our mind distracted by this autopilot, you know, kind of our thinking mind, our brain is easily hijacked by our sympathetic nervous system, which some people also call the fight or flight response. And that is part of this limbic system as well. And you might wonder, like, fight or flight, like, I mean, we're not dealing with lions and tigers trying to eat us, right? But the modern day challenges that our body perceives or our mind perceives as a threat are, you know, maybe that red light that's going to make you late somewhere, or maybe your kid not responding to you, or maybe someone making a comment that threatens your identity or status, and your body will instinctually respond with the sympathetic nervous system. It's an automatic reaction. And so it hijacks what's called our thinking brain. So what happens is, I like to describe it by using the description Dan Siegel does at UCLA, which is flipping your lid. So if you think of your arm here, this wrist and arm here, area here, this is like the brain stem in your brain. Your thumb is like your amygdala, which is connected to that posterior cingulate gyrus. And it's kind of like the core of that fight or flight emotional response system. And then these fingers are the prefrontal cortex or our thinking brain. So if you've ever been in an argument, we've all probably been in an argument, right? And maybe said something we kind of regret later. What's happened is when you're angry, you're in this sympathetic state and you flip your lid. So your thinking brain is offline now and you're reacting based on this limbic system. And until you bring your awareness to that, you can't bring your thinking brain back online. So it's kind of scary a little bit, right, to think that your brain's doing things that you aren't always maybe thinking that you're in control with. But there are ways to kind of hijack that system, that innate system, and that's by increasing our awareness. Because most of the time, there are bodily sensations that will kind of warn us that this is going to happen, right? Like when you're in a conversation, like if you think about it, you might notice some tension or tightness in your stomach, things like this. Well, the more you become aware of that, the more you can kind of say like, oh, you know what? If I don't stop right now, I'm going to flip my lid, you know? The other thing to realize is that, again, despite how evolved we are as humans and how great we think we are creatures of habit. And this, you know, is something that we fall into. Actually, I'm going to back up here real quick because I forgot to review this slide, which is just to show you the science that they actually have studies now because of these functional MRI scanners that show that people who are experienced meditators, which mindfulness is a form of, can deactivate that autopilot or posterior cingulate activity more so than people who haven't done it. Like they've never done it in their life, just monitoring them acting. But the cool thing is that they've been able to show that people who start to learn this process, you don't have to be an Olympic meditator like someone who goes to a Buddhist monastery or something like that, can get benefits from this. So sorry about skipping that, but we'll move forward here. So the key about the habit loop is to understand how it's kind of formed again, how we are these creatures of habit. Think about how you learn to brush your teeth. So you probably had a parent who was balking at you, brush your teeth, brush your teeth, brush your teeth. And then you did the behavior, you brushed your teeth, and you got a reward, which was your parents were happy and they stopped yelling at you, right? Most of us don't need someone to tell us to brush our teeth anymore, right? Because we have a stimulus. Same basic cycle, we get up in the morning. So the time is the stimulus. You do the behavior, you brush your teeth, and the reward is you have good smelling breath, nobody complains about it at work, you know, things like that. But almost, like, literally, almost everything we do can be whittled down to this habit loop. And another reason why I bring this up is because when we do that, we are laying down pathways in our brain, okay? Just like pathways in a wood, okay? So when we've created a habit, we've created a strong, clear, easy pathway to go through, right? If you came to a fork in a road, which path would you take? Probably the right one. Because the left one here, it's looks a little dangerous, you might have to walk around things, and it's not very clear. And if you've ever tried to create a new habit, you can realize how hard that is sometimes, right? Because, again, if you're on autopilot, when you get to that stimulus, you're just going to go down the clear path. But the good news is they have discovered in science something called neuroplasticity. That, you know, they used to think that our brains were developed, the ones they developed, they didn't really change. Well, that doesn't seem to be true anymore. And the way we form new habits or new pathways is by repeating something over and over and over and over. So if someone goes, if someone were to travel down this path enough times, right, it would start to look like this other path. And the same thing happens in your brain. So when you trigger off that cycle, it creates a stronger connection, a faster path, and your brain is more likely to do it. Okay? So how does mindfulness fit into that? Well, again, in the habit loop there of the stimulus, response, and reward, it kind of teaches you to make that pause. So instead of automatically going down one path, you choose. You may choose to still go down that path, or you may choose to do the other activity. And I think I have to come over here because I wanted to try to show a clip it here to better understand that. We'll see if it works. This is Judson Brewer, who is the director at the Center.
When I was first learning to meditate, the instruction was to simply pay attention to my breath, and when my mind wandered, to bring it back. The instruction was simple enough, but I was missing something really important. So why is it so hard to pay attention? It turns out that we're fighting one of the most evolutionarily conserved learning processes currently known in science. This reward-based learning process is called positive and negative reinforcement, and basically goes like this. We see some food that looks good, calories, survival. We eat the food, we taste it, it tastes good. Our bodies send a signal to our brain that says, remember what you're eating and where you found it. See food, eat food, feel good, repeat. Trigger, behavior, reward. Well, after a while, our creative brains say, you know, next time you feel bad, why don't you try eating something good so you'll feel better? Same process, just a different trigger. Maybe in our teenage years, and we see those rebel kids outside smoking, we think, hey, I want to be cool, so we start smoking. See cool, smoke to be cool, feel good. Now with these same brain processes, we've gone from learning to survive to literally killing ourselves with these habits. In my lab, we studied whether mindfulness training could help people quit smoking. Now with mindfulness training, we'd focused on being curious. What? Yeah, we said, go ahead and smoke. Just be really curious about what it's like when you do. And what did they notice? Well, here's an example from one of our smokers. She said, mindful smoking smells like stinky cheese and tastes like chemicals. What she discovered just by being curiously aware when she smoked was that smoking tastes like shit. She started to become disenchanted with her behavior. The prefrontal cortex understands that we shouldn't smoke, and it tries its hardest to help us change our behavior. Unfortunately, this is also the first part of our brain that goes offline when we get stressed out. Now, when the prefrontal cortex goes offline, we fall back into our old habits, which is why this disenchantment is so important. Seeing what we get from our habits helps us understand them in a deeper level. But over time, as we learn to see more and more clearly the results of our actions, we let go of old habits and form new ones. Mindfulness is just about being really interested in getting close and personal with what's actually happening in our bodies and minds from moment to moment. And this willingness to turn toward our experience is supported by curiosity, which is naturally rewarding. It feels good. We start to notice that cravings are simply made up of body sensations. Oh, there's tightness, there's tension, there's restlessness, and that these body sensations come and go. This might sound too simplistic to affect behavior, but in one study we found that mindfulness training was twice as good as gold standard therapy at helping people quit smoking. So it actually works. So if you don't smoke or stress eat, maybe the next time you feel this urge to check your email when you're bored or you're trying to distract yourself from work, see if you can just be curiously aware of what's happening in your body and mind in that moment. Notice the urge, get curious, feel the joy of letting go, and repeat. Thank you.
So, like I tried to mention before I got that up there, he's actually the current director at what is called the Center of Mindfulness and Medicine Society, and there's another term there that I'm forgetting, which was started actually by psychologist Jon Kabat-Zinn. When he defines mindfulness as paying attention in a particular way on purpose in the present moment and without judgment. So he developed this mindfulness-based stress reduction in about 1979, actually, as a way to address symptoms that people were having that could not be managed or treated by the current medical system. There are many other definitions out there that kind of, you know, present this in a different way, but I like to stick with this one because I'm a doctor, and it comes from the medical field. So some of you may have heard the term mindfulness or meditation and kind of brought to mind, you know, that oh, this is for people that maybe look like this. So it's not for me. It's not something for the average Joe or, you know, Midwest kind of person. But the reality is that a lot of people are doing this. Kobe Bryant who's a big basketball player. The whole Seattle Seahawks team, in fact, this is one of the pillars of their training for the mental game, is participating in mindfulness. Corporations like Google, Procter & Gamble, and you'll see some other extensions of that later. And why do they do this? Because of the benefits that have been shown. So people who engage in mindfulness, various studies have been able to show, can increase their attention, their focus, and their working memory. Right? Because if you're not paying attention, you're not very likely to remember what's going on at that time. A study at Central Michigan University was able to demonstrate people who participated in certain forms of mindfulness meditation were less biased to people because of age or race. So not making judgments about people just by how they look. They have found that it reduces or increases the ability of a person to respond in a stressful situation. So the military has been using this, the Army and the Marines are another place where this is being used. It's been shown to improve relationship satisfaction, decrease rumination, stress. These are kind of general applications for it in anyone's life. But also, there's a lot of scientific data out there now, and there's an increasing volume of this to show benefits, again, as its initial intention, which is to help manage symptoms of people who have maybe conditions that the standard medical treatment is not helping. So you can see on there some of the ones that maybe you wouldn't think of are high blood pressure, pain, grief. You know, the list is kind of ongoing, but I want to emphasize that it's not required to have a medical diagnosis to benefit from this. This is really just a fundamental way for anyone to thrive in the difficult situation, which is called life. So the other challenge that some people try to say, I don't have time for mindfulness. It's just one more thing to do on my to-do list. You know, where am I going to fit it in? Well, the exciting news is, like I said, you don't have to be an Olympic meditator. You don't have to be spending weeks and months in a place. They have been able to show that people can get in as little as 10 minutes a day on a consistent basis, very good results of decreased activation of that posterior cingulate gyrus area. There are actually studies that also suggest that there are actually increased brain volumes in the prefrontal cortex of people who participate in this, as well as decreased size of that amygdala, or that fight or flight system. The truth of the matter is, it's kind of like exercise. You know, even if you can start with 1 minute a day, it's 1 minute. Something is better than nothing. Some people have said, oh, I've tried meditation or something like that and it didn't work for me. I couldn't do it. I couldn't shut my mind off. Well, that's actually not the purpose of meditation. It's not to clear your mind. It's not for your mind to be empty. It's for awareness and attention. So it's to become, increase your attention to become more focused on, oh, there's a thought. Is that a thought about the past? Is that a thought about the future? Okay, but it's just a thought. I'm going to let it pass. What's the next thought that comes up? Okay, there's another thought. Because most of us kind of think that all of our thoughts are facts. But if you kind of fact check sometimes your thoughts, it's not really accurate, right? A lot of times when you interview people, you know, what they will say to themselves in their head is not anything they would ever say to a friend or their child. We can be kind of mean to ourselves. So it's to just acknowledge those and kind of be aware. And then the exercise is to then bring your attention back to whatever the focus was. And so that's what the exercise is, okay? It's not to clear the mind. The exercise is to notice the thought, and then to bring your attention back. And so that's the bicep curl, or that's the crunch, or that is the exercise. So if you do it 100 times during a minute, hey, you just practiced 100 times. You know, you got distracted, but you became aware and you brought your attention back. So you can make that muscle stronger, just like you can with physical exercise. So I'm going to let the expert here finish off with kind of a great summary.
This is just the next generation of exercise. We've got the physical, you know, exercise components down, and now it's about working out how can we actually train our minds.
Dr. Brewer is trying to understand how mindfulness can alter the functioning of the brain. He uses a cap lined with 128 electrodes.
We're going to start filling each of these 128 wells with conduction gel.
The electrodes are able to pick up signals from the posterior cingulate, part of a brain network linked to memory and emotion.
This is all just picking up electrical signal from the top of your head.
Since attending the mindfulness retreat, I'd been meditating daily and was curious to see if it had an impact on my brain.
We're going to have you start with thinking of something that was very anxiety-provoking for you.
Okay.
When I thought about something stressful, the cells in my brain's posterior cingulate immediately started firing, shown by the red lines that went off the chart on the computer screen.
Just drop into meditation.
Okay.
When I let go of those stressful thoughts and refocused on my breath, within seconds, the brain cells that had been firing quieted down, shown by the blue lines on the computer.
That's really fascinating to see it like that.
Dr. Brewer believes everyone can train their brains to reach that blue mindfulness zone, but he says all the technology we're surrounded by makes it difficult.
So, hopefully I have brought to you some sense of kind of the science behind this and some of the benefits of this, as well as got some of the misconceptions out of the way of what that is. And I'm going to hand things over to Mark here, who's going to now show us how we can exercise in this way.